God's name do you need to solve it for except to kill someone?
It's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Mark Latham. Good morning, Mark. How are you on this windy and warm Sunday morning, the first day of spring?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks, Brent. And happy Father's Day to all the great dads out there. We sort of don't get a lot of recognition by and large in many of the households, just slave away. But today's pretty good because we get breakfast cooked for us in the morning, some presents, and the love and attention, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great day. And I suppose if you don't have your dad with you anymore, it's a day for you to stop and think and remember the wonderful times that you shared with your dad as well on Father's Day.
Yeah, it's useful in that regard, and it is the first day of spring, coincidentally. So, you know, for some families, it's a new beginning or a time of reflection about dads who passed away. In my case, over 40 years now, but you always remember your dad, love him, and treasure the time you had together and the good start that most people have had in life.
Yeah, my wife and I were sitting out the back last night having a chat. And my dad's wife passed away when she was 10. And so he's been gone a long time now. And you never forget, do you? We were talking about it last night. You never forget those special times, no matter how many years they've been passed.
Yeah, those memories are precious. And I suppose a reminder, if your dad's still with you today, make the best of that, make the most of that. And share as much love and cuddles and affection as you can.
Yeah, good words. Labor is on track to lose more seats to the Greens in the next federal election. Political pundits are warning as the Prime Minister has angered the LGBTQIA. I've got to think about this when I say it now, Mark. There's so many things in there. The LGBTQIA+. Got to put that plus in there so we're completely inclusive. He's angered that community over the inclusion in the census. He's done a backflip. Or someone pointed out to me yesterday, Mark, it's not really a backflip, because when you do a backflip, you end up facing the same way you started. It's, in fact, a turnaround.
Well, it's a change in direction, I suppose.
Yes,
that's true.
It is.
But with all those letters you read out, I think you missed a few there, Brent, along the way. I just used the shorthand, the alphabet advocates, because they've got half the alphabet now in that long descriptor. But I think the bottom line in the census is that there's, basically this LGBT alphabet community, it breaks into two groups. One are the political activists who, wear those letters literally on their sleeve and get out there and advocate and talk about it all the time. But I think for most Australians, including in that group, sexuality and these types of matters, intersex, gender, pansexual, whatever these things mean, is a very intensely private matter. And there's a reluctance to put on a public document like the census things that a lot of people would think, well, that's really not the business of government to know. What I do in the bedroom, literally. So I think that has been the issue. And when they last asked the question about gender fluidity and transgender, that was in the last census, only 1,500 Australians said they were transgender, which is 0.006% of the population. Now, it might be more than that, but it's a bit of an indicator that people generally are reluctant to record these things on a document held by the government, one day released by the government, potentially. So I would have thought that the ABS, the statistician, should just stay out of it altogether. And they've said officially that the amount of people who respond to these questions is so minor to be statistically insignificant and even statistically inaccurate. The margin of error is too great. So I don't think Albanese needed to do anything. But he's caved in effectively to the first group of those alphabet advocates who are loud and noisy and demanding all the time. But I still think whatever the question's going to be, if you're gay, straight, bisexual, whatever the question is in the Senate, in the census, a lot of people will be reluctant to fill it out because they think it's just private.
Yeah, I had someone send me, we talked a little bit about this yesterday, and I had someone send me an email asking the question, with all the technology that we have these days, government are watching you left, right and centre, you know, banks are watching you left, right and centre, the ATO are watching you left, right and centre, they know how much money you've got in your bank accounts and all those sort of things. Why do we still need to have a census? Is it a kickback to, you know, years gone by and no one's really thought, well, do we really need this anymore? What do they do with the information they gather from the census that they don't already have?
Well, that's a very interesting point, isn't it? And perhaps information technology and monitoring of people's information has overtaken the traditional need for this census, which is a bit horse and buggy because it's a, you know, a piece of paper you fill out and it gets collected at your doorstep. What they do with it, I suppose government will say that their demographers and geography experts use the data to get a handle on what sort of needs are evident in a particular suburb or country town, where's the Australian population moving in its composition. You don't actually hear a lot of public policy made with reference to the Senate. So you raise a pretty good point there. You know, I've been in the New South Wales Parliament the last 5 years, and just off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of the number of times legislation comes forward where the minister says, this is needed because the census has shown such and such. So you don't see a lot of that, and it may be a good question, you know, down the track, do we really need this? But I think overall, there is a public mood of too much intrusion into our privacy, too much knowledge on social media in particular of what we're doing. It's like if you say on social media, I'm interested in vintage cars, it feels like 10 seconds later you get a lot of vintage cars advertisements popping up in your feed.
You do, yeah.
So, you know, I think that worries people. I think that worries people, and you're not getting... Probably one of the other problem with the census is you're probably not getting accurate information, particularly of a personal kind, because people are just reluctant to say those things to anyone.
Yeah. It's very, very true, and I suppose, look, you know, the emailer was basically saying, you know, the amount of money, again, that we spend on putting the census together, surely it could be put in different areas to do more good.
It does cost a lot, and I think the electronic one, was it last time or the time before? It was a meltdown? It collapsed, or, you know, there's also a worry about the Chinese hacking it and so forth. Wasn't there a collapse in one of the census when they tried to go online and it was a debacle and
yeah,
had to start again? So there's delivery problems with it. It's become controversial. You know, 30 years ago, the census, well, it was just sort of as plain as the nose on your face. But now it seems to be a constant source of controversy as well. So perhaps a complete review of its usefulness would be pretty handy in the first place.
Okay, let's talk about this mine near Orange. I said this morning, there's a story out today that says that Tanya Plibersek's environmental rationale for blocking the proposed gold mine near Orange has been contradicted by, of all bodies, the New South Wales Environment Protection Authority. The Environment Minister, as in Ms. Plibersek, she's repeatedly claimed that she slapped a Section 10 Aboriginal Heritage Protection Notice on the site of this proposed gold mine at Blaney because it would destroy the river. But the EPA has confirmed the impact would have been minimal. Mark, we've had Chris Minns come out this week and say he thinks it should go ahead. We've had the Prime Minister say he thinks this mine at Blaney should go ahead. Now that the EPA have come out and said, well, we think it should go ahead as well, do you think by week's end Tanya Plibersek will do a about turn?
Well, I certainly hope so. But it indicates, I think, a cultural problem we've got in Australian politics now about mining in general. Mining has been one of the backbones of our economy, obviously generates a lot of wealth and employment, essential to our prosperity. But Brent, the problem is now that a minister like Plibersek would look at this not for the reasons the mine should be approved, but for grasping at reasons why it should be knocked on the head. And she's come up with two things that are apparently just not valid. One, that Indigenous people are against it when the local Aboriginal Land Council there out near Orange and Blaney has supported it, and they say that the opponents of it are not even from their clan, not even from their mob locally. So the Indigenous reason apparently is fraudulent. And the other one is on environmental grounds when it has passed every single thing that needs to be done in the tests of the New South Wales government to be environmentally sound. And I can tell you what, there's a lot of tests. And if you get anything through the New South Wales government bureaucracy these days on the environmental front, then it must be a pretty good development. So she said that the tailings dam, this is the stuff that gets separated out from what, you know, what they're really looking for, the gold, will damage the river. The Environmental Protection Authority in New South Wales has said that's not true. So it seems like Plibersek has been swept up in anti-mining culture instead of just assessing this on its merits and actually giving it a big tick.
It'll be interesting to see what happens by week's end, because this story is just not going to go away. I thought it would, Mark. I read it, talked about it, and thought, oh, look, it'll go away. But it's not. It's now, what, week three, I think, week three we're now talking about this. So maybe by the end of week three, that decision will be reversed. There seems to be a lot of pressure for it to be done.
Well, it also raises the question, who's running the federal government? If the Prime Minister has said he wants it to go ahead.
True.
Surely that should be enough. Is he running the government, or what? Plibersek's got some special veto power on projects and some special hold over Albanese such that his word counts for nothing, along with Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, and apparently these New South Wales agencies on the environmental front that have said that it should go ahead. So Plibersek is increasingly isolated, and yeah, I hope by week's end she backs down and the mine is approved.
The state opposition leader, Mark Speakman, that's his name, yes, folks. His name is Mark Speakman. He's the opposition leader in New South Wales. We rarely hear from him. He's called for unity during an appearance at a state executive meeting held hours after police charged the Liberal MP Rory Amon with 10 child sexual assault offences. Now, we should say Mr Amon has denied any wrongdoing, and he has vowed to fight the charges. He has resigned from Parliament, prompting a by-election in his seat of Pittwater. The Telegraph has been told that Mr Speakman declared at a meeting on Friday night of the State Executive that the seats of Pittwater, Epping and Hornsby remain winnable. What's your thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, it's a shocking thing. Rory Amon has the presumption of innocence, of course, but it's shocking news in Parliament House and indeed the community that a state MP has resigned because he's been charged with very serious paedophilia offences. So, you know, being elected to Parliament is the ultimate declaration of trust in an individual. We'll find out what the courts say about this and what the justice system decides. But to have an MP causing a by-election for this reason is dreadful. It comes on top of another Liberal MP. He's out of their party now, but he's still in the Parliament, who's got some similar, probably not as serious charges from what I can tell. But to have this with the New South Wales Liberal Party is shocking. And Speakman, yeah, he seems to get publicity when things blow up badly, like the failure to nominate their local government candidates, and now this series of by-elections and other charges that are yet to be heard in the court. Is there a problem inside the New South Wales Liberal Party? Do they need to fix up their selection processes? Well, it seems that that is the case. Do they need to fix up the efficiency of their administration? I'd say so, but at the moment you'd say Chris Minns is probably going to go to the next election saying, if the Liberal Party can't run themselves, how can they run New South Wales? And unfortunately, that seems quite valid at the moment.
Yeah, sad but true. I just don't hold any hope for the Liberal Party in New South Wales with Mr Speakman in charge. I'm sorry, but...
I think one of their problems is, if I, you know, I get to talk to these people and see them in Parliament and the like, they don't represent the mainstream of the community as they might have done 30 or 40 years ago. The Liberal Party has got some sort of strange machine, apparatchik thing going, the staffers they bring through, the types of people. They're not representative of your average Liberal supporter out in the community. I could walk down the main street of Camden near where I live and talk to Liberals, and they'll have a totally different conversation in the community to what the Liberal MPs actually talk about in the Parliament. And I think that gap in values and outlook is a huge problem for them, and the sort of people they're bringing through self-evidently are not the quality of individual that you need to form government and do a good job for the state.
I see this gin story for Karen Webb, the police commissioner, is not going away. It was talked about in budget estimates on Friday. You want to tell us more about that, Mark?
Well, I was in a different set of budget estimates, scrutinising the waste of money in the New South Wales Parliament itself. But my colleague Rod Roberts in the upper house was at the estimates with the police minister and the police commissioner. I'm sure drilling further into why the police commissioner purchased so many gin bottles and is handing them out to other people as gifts and hospitality and the like. There's enough challenges in policing without going down that path. So I'm not expert on what was uncovered there, but Rod's done a really good job to bring to public attention this and other problems. And unfortunately, the police commissioner's response was to sort of say, shoot the messenger, have an investigation as to where the information's come from. And I think the very clear message to Karen Webb is do your job, solve these problems before we need whistleblowers to come out and tell the community and the public about them. Actually fix the problems inside the police force and then you won't have any leaks.
What happened in your session of budget estimates?
Well, there's always problems. We've spent $22 million on replacing the roof of Parliament House. Now, they say Parliament House is an old building. The front of it is, not the back section in my eyes. But they spent $22 million replacing the roof, and there's still water leakages into the office of Rod Roberts, who I just mentioned, on the 11th floor, two stories down from the roof itself. So, you know, we talk about those issues, and the fact that, quite remarkably, the New South Wales Parliament has had a 50% increase in staffing over the last 5 years. But I raise some issues where the job of the MP is actually more difficult because a lot of the staffing increases has gone into, how's it best described, HR, where they're dealing with mock outrage and hurt feelings, and there's people there who'll hold your hand if you know, you're not feeling too good about yourself. Well, I think there's more important things MPs need to do their job effectively, and a lot of the money is wasted in state parliament. So I was in that session, and Rod Roberts was there grilling the police.
Speaking of, well, I would suggest it might be a waste of money. It was a story that came to light today that one of the headlines say DFAT spent $20,000 of taxpayer funds on a didgeridoo performance at a summer of cricket event launched in India. So they spent 20 grand on taking a bloke overseas. Now, I might add, he's apparently a very, very good didgeridoo player, but they paid him $11,000 to play the didgeridoo for a very, very short period of time. And I tried to prove this morning, Mark, that, you know, we've got our very own Aboriginal didgeridoo music here. It didn't cost me $11,000, let me tell you.
Yeah, you've got to ask, what's it got to do with cricket? I mean, this is one of the problems, isn't it? Every single government-type event now has got to have an Indigenous content. An Indigenous display, even though in the case of cricket, wouldn't you say, you know, the left-wing people would say, isn't that a colonial game that was brought here in 1788 by the white British people and so forth? It's certainly not an Indigenous game. But that's the problem. We spend a lot of public money. You can go to a road opening in Western New South Wales, Brent, and they pay someone to do a welcome to country. They've got obviously nothing to do with the road. You can go to any government event now, and they're paying government money, taxpayers' money, for people to do all sorts of Indigenous things. They've got nothing to do with the event and the thing that's being opened or celebrated. So it's part of the system now. It is the ultimate form of virtue signalling. $20,000 for a didgeridoo player for cricket in India. Well, there's no limit to this madness, is there?
It's just not cricket, Mark.
Certainly not cricket. And can the bloke actually play cricket? We don't know.
Just when you thought it was, well, the Albanese government couldn't find new and inventive ways to impose more bad policies on us, the Education Minister, Jason Clare, he enters the room. He's come up with the not-so-bright idea of imposing a cap on foreign students attending top-tier universities. This was a story at the beginning of the week, Mark.
Well, there needs to be some sort of limit, because if you look at the University of Sydney, University of New South Wales, it's getting to the point where a majority of their income is dependent on overseas students. And we saw in the COVID period how risky that is, just in financial risk management. You don't want to put so many eggs in that basket. And part of it is the whole question with China. What if the relationship with China breaks down? We lose that university income. The universities themselves would be left stranded. And in some cases, during COVID, there was speculation they might go broke because they'd been so dependent on the overseas students. Some academics, of course, say that these students don't receive the same sort of testing and rigour to pass their degrees. The universities are so dependent on this income now that the system's become soft, and these are sort of, you know, it's just handout type degrees that anyone from overseas can get once they pay their money. It actually hasn't got the rigour you'd expect from a university. So there's been a whole range of problems. So I think a sensible cap would make a lot of sense.
But what are the numbers? 270,000, they said. The story I was referring to was 270,000, and they're suggesting 20,000 only, capping, knocking off 20,000. It's not a big...
Well, that's not
it's
much,
not,
yeah.
It's not
that's
much,
not
is
much.
It?
And they won't solve the problem at Sydney and New South Wales University, where they've become over-reliant on this form of income. And I think also the Australian taxpayers and students with HECS and all that fund the university system would logically say the first priority in Australian higher education should be Australian students. And a lot of Australian students are thinking that's no longer the case.
Barely half of the homes that need to be built in Sydney to meet the ambitious housing targets will actually going to be built, surprise, surprise, with the Minns government set for a shortfall by 2029, mark of 150,000 homes.
Well, that's because the approval system is still so slow. Even at budget estimates I attended on Wednesday, the Premier was saying that you need to jump through 1,000 hoops. That's what he actually said, 1,000 hoops to get a development approved in New South Wales. Now, what's his solution to that? It's not to streamline the system, cut out the red tape, cut out the green tape, and actually reduce 1,000 hoops down to a couple. His solution is things like the sale of Rose Hill, where he's giving a shortcut method of doing that development, doesn't stack up and it'll probably fall over. So Chris Minns, in many respects, is dodging the real issue, and that is fix the complexity of the New South Wales development approval system, abolish things like the planning commission that we don't need, streamline the system, put targets for local government approving developments within a certain period of time, quite reasonably so, and actually fix the system instead of shortcuts for people that he knows at the Australian Turf Club.
Okay, Mark, I'll let you get back to your family and continue to celebrate Father's Day. And we thank you for taking the time on Father's Day to spend with us on a Sunday morning. We appreciate it,
all the best
mate.
To the fathers, and have a great day, and watch the footy, have a few beers, kick back, and make sure everyone looks after you.
Terrific. Thanks, mate. We'll talk to you next Sunday.
Cheers. Thank you.
See ya. That's Mark Latham.